Take your Bibles and turn tonight to the book of Psalms 19, Psalm 19. And we're starting a series here on apologetics. How do we know that certain things are true? Why do we believe what we believe? How can we give an answer for the reason of the hope that lies within? Rose this past week had to give a speech in speech class at Frederick Community College and did it on this postmodernism. And can we know absolute truth? And a little nervous giving that kind of speech. You did a great job, I understand. But these are the things that we're just going to be facing more and more in the days ahead. It used to be just taken for granted that God exists. Not so much so anymore. I have been reading a book called The Reason for God by Timothy Keller, a pastor up in New York. He pastors in the city of New York and has a number of young adults in his congregation and therefore a lot of challenges as he is giving a defense for the gospel, for the scriptures. And he was talking with one young man who was a very bright individual and trying to wrestle with, does God exist? How can I know that? And he made this statement to Pastor Keller. He says, I cannot believe unless I find at least one absolutely airtight proof for God. And yet this person here is assuming a strong rationalism that had no airtight proof for it. Well, who's to say that you will have an airtight proof for anything? And that was kind of the basis now for their study. And so this young man and the pastor began to sit down, began to work through some of these things. And what he decided to do with this young man was to say, okay, let's look at clues here. And I haven't used that term before in connection with proofs for the existence of God. But I have said that there's not one argument in and of itself that wins the argument, but it's this argument upon argument upon argument. It's the preponderance of the evidence that makes it very clear that there's only one reasonable explanation for what you see around, and that is that there is a God. And that's where I want to look here, first of all, in Psalm 19, first couple of verses. This is a very unique psalm. Psalm 19 deals with the revelation of God. And in theology, we talk about general revelation and special revelation. General revelation is revelation about God that you pick up from nature around. That's general revelation. We would say that creation, for instance, is probably the strongest argument for general revelation, that there is a God and tells us a little bit about Him. And then we say special revelation. Special revelation is revealed or communicated revelation, and we typically say that's God's Word, the Bible. And so the last half of this psalm, verses 7 and following, deal with special revelation. Verses 1 through 6 deal with general revelation. And it's important for us to understand, too, that we cannot get saved from purely general revelation. We must have special revelation, a word from God, from His Word. Faith cometh by hearing. Hearing by the creation of God? No. Hearing by the Word of God. And I believe that God uses general revelation, like creation, to draw men to Himself so that they can then hear the Word of God, special revelation. But tonight we want to focus on the general revelation of God. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament showeth His handiwork. Day unto day pours forth, uttereth speech. Night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. They don't have to worry about translating this into other languages. It doesn't matter what corner of the globe you find yourself or what language you speak. There it is for everybody to see. The glory of God. The sun, the moon, the stars, creation itself. A tremendous testimony of the existence of a creator. Verse 4, their line is gone out through all the earth and their words to the end of the world. And so it is that God has given us this wonderful world, this wonderful creation to proclaim, to declare, to show forth the existence of God. You don't need to turn there, but in Psalm 8, verses 3 through 4, when I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And I can tell you, the stronger the telescopes are and the further they see, the smaller we get and the bigger our God. And I'm here to make this proclamation tonight that creation itself teaches the existence of God. Let's take a look, first of all, at this mysterious bang, or the existence of the world. Why is there something rather than nothing? Now that, to me, is a pretty big question. How did it all get here? I remember years ago, as a little boy, I grew up in a good church, a Christian home, went to a Christian school, learned about creation, thought evolution was foolish. But my grandfather was a well-respected, well-known scientist, especially in the nuclear, in the areas of nuclear and laser technology. As a young man, he got his master's from Cornell University, ended up teaching at the University of Chicago, and was involved with the Argonne Laboratories and Fermi Lab in the Chicago area. And actually knew men like Enrico Fermi and Oppenheimer and those guys, because as a young man, he was drafted into this somewhat shady organization that sent him down to Oak Ridge, Tennessee during World War II. My grandmother had no idea what he was doing, but somehow he was working for the Army as a civilian, but he was in the Army. And he was working on a little-known project at the time called the Manhattan Project. And here he was, and these men, they're dealing with areas of science that nobody really knew that much about. And when they detonated that first bomb, they weren't quite sure what was going to happen. Would this set the entire world on fire? Would there be a nuclear chain reaction that they could not stop that would just end life as we know it? They didn't think so. But those were indeed heady days for science. Then my grandfather ended up going into laser technology. He saw the future of lasers, knew that that would be a cutting edge, no pun intended, of much of science and medical industry in years ahead. Would end up forming a company to work with lasers. And so a very well-published, well-known, well-respected scientist. I just knew him as Grandpa. It was funny, on long trips from Chicago to Colorado, where they bought a place up in the mountains, long trips, I would sit in the front seat, my grandma would be in the back sleeping, and my grandfather would be driving, and I'd be sitting there, and I was probably 10, and he'd be teaching me logarithms. I had no idea what he was talking about, but he just enjoyed that, and so I had a great deal of respect for the intelligence of my grandfather. And I remember one day coming to him, Grandpa, do you believe in evolution? And he said, oh, yes, of course. It's very scientific. I said, I was devastated. But everybody believes in creation, because that was my world, you know. I said, Grandfather, how did everything get here then? And he looked at me and he says, you know, that's the one thing I really, really struggle with when it comes to evolution. He said, I have no answer for that. And I remember as a young man, a little boy, really, thinking about that, and said, you know, I have the answer for that. I know how it all got here. And I told him. That didn't make a lot of difference to him at that point, but I think it maybe made him think. It was not until probably we were married at the time, probably in the early 90s, when I was in my younger 20s, that got word that my dad ended up leading my grandfather and grandmother to the Lord. But that one question, Grandpa, then where did it all come from? How did it start? And it did not the scientific, evolutionary, scientific reason for the existence of material in this universe, he had no answer. And that's a question that needs to be answered. There's evidence that the universe is expanding explosively. And expanding apparently from a single point. That's where they come up with this Big Bang idea. Stephen Hawking, well-known evolutionary scientist, physicist, I think, says, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning. Now, this to me is very interesting. Science has now gone to this place of saying that the material world, matter itself, could not be eternal. Now, that's interesting. Matter cannot be eternal. It had to have a beginning. Well, that doesn't really help them out, I don't think. Because if matter had to have a beginning, and that's interesting to me, because I believe that too, right? I believe that matter had a beginning. And it tells me that in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Francis Collins, in his book, The Language of God. Now, Francis Collins, my understanding is that he has taken the intelligent design position, but would be what I would call either probably theistic evolution. And the difference here, you've got evolution, God's not involved at all. Theistic evolution, God got it all started, and then evolution took its place, took its course. Then you have progressive creationism, which teaches that God got it started, evolution went along, then the next day, however many millions of years that might be, then God stepped in and got it to the next level, and then however many million years, and then God stepped in and got it to the next level. That's progressive creationism. And then there's creationism, which is what I believe the Bible teaches. I believe the Bible teaches that God created the world in 7 days, literally seven, actually six, 24-hour periods, and he rested on the seventh. And I can't get around the fact that the evening and the morning were the first day, and the evening and the morning were the second day. And so I would hold to a young earth, young 6 to 10,000 years the most that are Earth, the age of the Earth. But Francis Collins is probably more theistic type evolution. But he wrote a book called The Language of God, in which he states this. We have this very solid conclusion that the universe had an origin. Okay, so he says, solid conclusion. Like, nobody really argues this, that the universe started at some point. And to me, again, that's interesting. It didn't exist eternally. Nobody's saying that anymore. It had a start at some point. The Big Bang. 15 billion years ago, the universe began with an unimaginably bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. That implies that before that, there was nothing. I can't imagine how nature, in this case the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And it seems to me that it had to be outside of nature. All right, so do you see what he's saying? All right, however many years ago, we say 6 to 10,000 years ago, at some point, the universe began. How did the universe create itself? If you say Big Bang, you know, they say all the matter in the universe was compressed down to the size of a period on a page. Oh, man, that's one heavy dot. You know, that is incredibly incredible mass there, shrunk into that, and then it just exploded. Okay, where did you get the matter? Where did you get the energy? Don't really have an answer for that, but just happened. Okay, well then, how did the universe create itself? That's a problem too. We say, no, there was a cause outside of this universe, something in infinitely bigger than the universe, that caused it. The universe is an effect. God is the cause. What could that be but something outside of nature? A supernatural, non-contingent being that exists from itself. Some people have called this, kind of used this and talked about the cosmological argument, the fact that for every effect, there is some cause. So if you look out in the parking lot tonight, you see a car sitting there. Okay, you know, somebody had to build that. That car didn't just appear. It didn't just happen. And so the wind, the tree is moving back and forth. Okay, something's causing that movement. Okay, we know wind. We know that something's causing that wind. You know, the earth shifting and, you know, all this kind of stuff and hot and cold air and so forth. We know that there are causes, and then we know there are effects, and you start working your way back, and eventually you come to the fact, okay, what caused the earth? Things don't just happen on their own with no cause. Now, this argument from the fact that we have a universe, something must have caused it, something indefinitely big, something outside of the universe itself, something that's supernatural. This doesn't prove the existence of a personal, intelligent God, but it does provide us a clue to the probability of a cause outside of the universe that is greater than the universe. All right, so where did it all begin? This cosmological argument. There must be a force, at least, outside the universe that caused it. Number two, we'll call this the fine-tuning argument. In his book, Keller calls this the cosmic welcome mat. For organic life to exist, plants, trees, animals, fish, birds, people, for organic life to exist, the fundamental regularities and constants of physics, like the speed of light, gravitational constant, the strength of weak and strong nuclear forces, must all have values that together fall into an extremely narrow range. The probability of this perfect calibration of all of nature, all of these laws of physics, of science, have to be so exact and so just right for life to exist, there's no way that you could say it happened by accident, by chance. Again, Collins in his book, The Language of God, says, when you look from the perspective of a scientist at the universe, it looks as if it knew we were coming. There's 15 constants, the gravitational constant, various constants about the strong and weak nuclear forces, etc., that have precise values. If any one of those constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases, by one part in a million millions, the universe could not have actually come to the point where we see it. Matter would not have been able to coalesce. There would have been no galaxy, no stars, no planets, no people. In fact, Stephen Hawking concludes, the odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications. So how do you get a get around the fact that this world is so finely tuned for life to exist. How did that happen by accident? Well, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, comes up with this theory. You see, there are probably trillions, maybe an infinite number of parallel universes out there. Boy, wow, I had no idea. And because there are trillions, maybe an infinite number of universes, if you have an infinite number of universes and an infinite number of circumstances and things going on, that eventually, if you have an infinite number of things happening in an infinite number of universes, that eventually somewhere, sometime, life can come into being. At some point, they'll just accidentally get it right. By the way, it's hard to prove a universal negative, right? Can you prove that there aren't trillions of universes? How do you prove that there's no other universe? Of course, I'm also asked the question, well, how do you prove that there are? You know what their proof for millions and billions and trillions and infinite number of universes? You know what their proof is? We exist here today. All right. Think about this, though. This is, to me, how ridiculous this argument is. Infinite number of universes, and eventually, it will just happen. The law of averages tells us this. All right. Think about the Old West. There's a poker game going on. Card Shark playing, some other cowhands. He's taking their money left and right because 40 hands of poker in a row, as he is dealing the cards, somehow he has dealt 4 aces every single hand. 40 times in a row. Okay, I'm sure beforehand, but at least by the 40th time that he gets dealt 4 aces, those guys are standing up reaching for their 6 shooters. Now, imagine how ridiculous this would sound if he says, oh, whoa, 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 wait. Guys, don't you understand? There are trillions of parallel universes. And it just so happens in this universe, the odds are that I am dealing myself by chance these hands every single time. It's just unfortunate for you that you're in this particular universe at this time. Okay, how's that going to go over with these cowhands? Ah, that's ridiculous. That is not probable. You say, well, that's impossible. Well, we can't say it's impossible, right? Can you prove it? No. But it is so improbable to be impossible. Another individual, a guy by the name of John Leslie, was kind of thinking about this. He says, all right, so say you have a guy standing at a wall facing a firing squad. There are 50 expert marksmen with rifles standing 6 feet away from the guy. When the command to fire is given, all 50 miss him. Okay, what's the probable explanation there? Well, I guess that is one possible explanation, right? It is not probable that they all somehow accidentally missed him. I mean, there's reasonable explanations, even though you may not even be able to talk to those guys. You can kind of figure out what's taking place. Some people would call this, and there's another angle to this called the watchmaker theory or the teleological argument, the argument from design or purpose. The more design you see, the less probable that it happened by chance. And it's called sometimes the watchmaker theory because the illustration is given. You're walking along the beach. You find a watch there, finely crafted piece, instrument. You don't say to yourself, man, we just happen to be in that one universe where watches occur on the sandy shores of lakes. Wow. I'm glad I was born in this universe, you know. No, we don't think that. You know, it's kind of like, ever played the game of pickup sticks? All right, you take your bunch of pickup sticks and you drop it, and it just falls, and then you have to try and get the sticks without moving another stick and so forth, points for the different colors. And imagine, you know, I'm up here and I drop a whole handful of pickup sticks on the floor, and you come in tonight and you see across the floor in front here, John 3:16 spelled out with pickup sticks. I say, Pastor Ramlin, when did you have time to do that? I said, I just dropped them, and that's what happened. What? I mean, I could take the youngest child here and ask them, so do you think Pastor Ramler dropped these and this is what happened? They would say, of course not. I say, well, you're living in the universe where that could happen. Now, I mean, if you drop pickup sticks, you might get a letter. Yeah, there's the letter I. Yeah. Lowercase L, you know, you might get something like that. You might get a T, you know. But a word? A phrase? A sentence? A chapter? A book? I don't think so. All by chance? No, the higher the degree of sophistication and order and purpose, the less there is the chance could have caused that. And so we come to this argument then, this argument by design, or the teleological argument, or the fine-tuning universe argument. And you say, not only is there this infinite cause, but this infinite cause has intelligence, has purpose, has design. Yeah, there's still limitations here. It's not telling us that we have a personal God we're talking about, but at least an intelligent being who's infinitely greater than the universe itself. How about number three, the regularity of nature, or the laws of nature? You know, all scientific inductive reasoning is based upon the assumption that there are laws in nature. In fact, this was a real problem for some of the secular philosophers like David Hume or Bertrand Russell. They were troubled by the fact that we haven't got the slightest idea why there are laws in nature. We have no idea if they will always remain that way. You know, you've got the laws of thermodynamics, and you've got gravitational laws, and you've got things that just seem to occur over and over and over and over. Different places in the world, different circumstances, they're just laws. They become laws of nature. But we don't know how they got there. We don't know if they'll continue. But yet we build all of our science upon it. In fact, many scholars today even argue that modern science, and to me this is very interesting, modern science arose in its most sustained form out of Christian civilization. Because Christian scientists who were Christians, who were believers, held this belief in an all-powerful personal God who created and sustains an orderly universe. And because God is a God of order, therefore his creation is orderly, therefore we can take what we see, the order, and we can extrapolate from that and build theories and hypotheses and laws. But that doesn't surprise us, because Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. For by him, that is Jesus Christ, were all things created. I bet you Jesus made a really good carpenter. You think about that? He made a pretty good... And that word carpenter doesn't mean necessarily that he only worked with wood. He could have been a stonemason. But he built things. Can you imagine the creator of the universe building your kitchen? Well, that would have been a good kitchen. Well-made house, I'm sure. For by him, Jesus Christ, were all things created that are in heaven and that are in the earth, visible, invisible, whether it be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him. Verse 17, and he is before all things, and by him all things are maintained. All things consist. 2 Peter 3:7, but the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment. All right, so which are by the same word, what word are they talking about? Remember, in the beginning, God said a word, let there be light. By that same word, by the power even of his speech, he's able to keep the creation as it is. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 2 and 3 says, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, Jesus Christ, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds, so Jesus made the worlds, who being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power. Jesus maintains creation by the word of his power. What keeps an atom together with those opposite charges? I believe it's the word of his power. One day he's going to say the word and that will explode. And that will be fire like we've never seen before. And so it is that an argument based upon the natural laws, the regularity of nature, it didn't just happen by accident. This is an argument that I haven't really thought much about. Kind of just recently, the clue of beauty. Beauty. How does one account for the sense that we have of beauty? Love. Life. These abstract concepts. Joy and peace. If there's no God, and everything in this world is the product of an accidental collocation of atoms, everything just kind of came together, then there's really no actual purpose for which we were made. We were just accidents. And this is why people, our world today, struggles with, why am I here? Are you just an accident? Walking around the planet? Is love simply a biochemical response inherited from your ancestors who survived because that trait helped them survive? Is beauty nothing more than a neurological, hardwired response to particular data inputted? C.S. Lewis thought about this. He made this comment. He says, you can't, except in the lowest animal sense, be in love with a girl if you know and keep on remembering that all the beauties, both of her person and of her character, are a momentary and accidental pattern produced by the collision of atoms, and that your own response to them is only a sort of psychic phosphorescence arising from the behavior of your genes. You can't go on getting very serious pleasure from music if you know and remember that its air of significance is a pure illusion, that you like it only because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to like it. And yet, as people, even secular humanists, have listened to music or have appreciated art, they see purpose. And it seems to lend itself to this idea and this thought that there is purpose in life. There is order. There is arrangement. There is beauty. You say, well, you know, that's just feelings. You know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And yet, it's more than just feelings. It's an appetite we have, or a desire for that which makes sense, for that which is orderly, for that which brings feeling, creates emotion. St. Augustine, in his Confessions, reasoned that these unfulfillable desires that the world can't fulfill, these certain desires, they're clues to the reality of something more, of a God. In fact, Augustine came to this conclusion, thou, speaking to God, thou hast made us for thyself, and our heart is restless till it finds rest in thee. So this idea for beauty, we all have a hunger or a desire for that. Hunger doesn't necessarily prove that you're going to get a meal, but hunger does kind of prove that there's food that exists. And so it is that these desires correspond to real objects that satisfy those desires. Yes, so the sexual desire corresponding to the physical relationship. Physical appetite corresponds to food. If you're tired, that implies that there must be rest. That's what fulfills that need. Relational desires, you know, that feeling of loneliness, that's fulfilled by friendship. And so we see needs and desires and the fulfillment and how they're fulfilled. But what about things like peace, love, worship? These are desires. I would say, and I believe Ecclesiastes teaches this, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, that God has put eternity in our hearts. And there's only one thing that will fill that hole, and that's an eternal being. That's God. We are worshipers by nature. That's a longing, a desire that only God can satisfy. All right, human morality. Man's intellectual and moral nature must have had it for its author an intellectual and moral being. Okay, could you say this? Man, as an intellectual and moral being, has had a beginning on this planet. That's not hard to argue, is it? Sometimes we wonder how intelligent man is on the planet at times. But we say, yeah, okay, man, as an intellectual and moral being, at some point had a beginning on the planet. He didn't just live forever. He wasn't just always here. Material and unconscious forces do not give us a sufficient cause for man's conscience, will, or reason. Where did man get his conscience? Where did man get his will? Where did man get his reason? Did he get it from a rock? No. Where did he get this from? How did it evolve? How do consciences and will and morality evolve? How does reason evolve? There's no answer for that. Except for there must be an infinite cause outside of this universe who, with intelligent design, as a moral being, as a personal being, created man in his image. Wow. Seems like I remember reading something about that. God created man in his image. Man, as an effect, can only be referred to as from a cause possessing personality. And I would also argue that man's moral nature gives us a clue to the existence of a holy lawgiver and judge. And I'm not just making this up, because if we looked at Romans chapter 1, verse 32, and this is in a long passage of people who have completely denied the existence of God. And they've gone into all kinds of perversion and sin, including homosexuality, as one of the sins that they go into. But they're now idol worshippers. They've denied the existence of God. And then it ends, Romans chapter 1, verse 32, ends by saying this, who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. These people who deny the existence of God, they know the judgment of God. Anybody practically watching a movie and the bad guys are getting away with it, that is so frustrating. You want to see righteousness prevail. You want to see the good guys win. That's because we're wired that way. We like to see they lived happily ever after come across the screen. And I believe, by the way, that is a biblical ending. If you know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you will live happily ever after. That's not just some fairy tale. That's real. Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 tells us that God has given conscience to man. And the Gentiles who didn't even know the law of God, they did it because it was in their heart. They were created with a conscience. I think another argument for the existence of God is the universal awareness of God. There is a universal religious awareness of man that there is a supernatural. David Livingstone, as he was traipsing all throughout Africa in the 1800s, he'd come upon a village that was isolated. No white man had seen it in thousands of years. He came to this startling conclusion. He says, the existence of God and an afterlife are everywhere recognized in Africa. Everybody believes in God and believes in an afterlife. They didn't get that from the Catholic Church. Paul, even in Acts chapter 17, as he's arguing with the philosophers there in Athens, he said, even one of your Greek poets said, for we are his offspring, talking about God. They believed in a creator, a God. Whether you're Greek or whether you're a barbarian, there was this universal recognition of a God, a supernatural. It must be in the very nature of man. And that leads me then to the final argument. Congruity. This is argument from agreement. The answer that best explains all the facts is probably the right answer. You know, like sometimes you're doing this clue game or something, and you're trying to figure out, who did it, what's this, and, oh, I think it was so-and-so. Oh, wait a minute. They were actually eating breakfast with these other two people at the time, so it couldn't have been them. You have to come up with the answer that, the explanation that best answers every scenario. The key that fits all the locks is probably the right key. And so our belief in the existence of God is not simply the conclusion of a demonstration. Can I prove that God exists? In a laboratory? No. But I begin to look at this evidence and this evidence. And there's many, many more evidences. I just gave you a few tonight. You begin to look at this evidence and this evidence and this evidence, and the evidence begins to stack up pretty powerfully. And you begin to realize, in fact, Paul Sobus is not here tonight, but he and I have talked about, because Paul used to be an atheist. And as he's talked to people who are atheists, he says, I became a Christian because Christianity is the most reasonable of any belief out there. One theologian by the name of Strong, Augustus Strong, said that Christianity is like a bridge spanning the material world and the divine, the supernatural. And this bridge is well constructed. And he used several of these rational arguments that we've talked about, the cosmological and the teleological and the anthropological arguments. It's a very solid bridge of the existence of God. Now, he says the only problem is that doesn't reach all the way to the shore. So you have to make this leap from the bank onto the bridge. We call that faith. But for Christianity, it's leaping onto a solid bridge. For evolution, it's a leap, but there's no bridge. The problem is they don't want to be on that bridge, so they got to cross some other way. And there's no other bridge. And so it's a free fall. And they're grasping at everything they can, because there's no alternative. You see, it's not just the Bible that teaches. We're going to get around to how do I know the Bible is the Word of God at another time. It's not just the Bible that teaches us and it expects us to understand this, but it's creation itself. It's the very reason that God has given us that argues very convincingly there must be a God. There is no other explanation.